Hey everybody, this is Tom Salemi of Device Talks. Welcome back to the Device Talks weekly podcast. We're all aware that MedTech is super cool, but we're going to touch upon a lot of the coolest elements of a very cool area. We're talking about space robots. We're talking about cyborgs. We're talking about superheroes. We're talking about tiny little tunneling drills that'll deliver medicine, perhaps insulin one day. So today's episode is really an exploration of what we can be. It's an exploration of space as well. So we'll have two guests for you today. First, Chris and I will speak with Chris Newmarker, my podcast partner, and I will speak with Shreya Srinivasan. She is an assistant professor of bioengineering at Harvard University's School of Engineering and Applied Sciences. We'll talk about a lot of the various projects that they have going on there, including a lot to do with neural interfaces. And because of that, Shreya Srinivasan will be on our neuro panel at Device Talks Boston on May 1st, where we'll have a panel discussion with folks talking about materials, talking about interfaces. We'll have Caro Aguilar from InBrain. We'll have Kurt Hagstrom from Synchron. We'll have Imran Iba from Action Potential Venture Capital, the venture group. So lots of different perspectives on where neuro is going, and I think Shreya adds a great element to that. So enjoy this podcast, but also make sure you join us on May 1st and 2nd at Device Talks Boston. I'm recording this on Friday at 2:45 Eastern Time. Just to let you know, our early bird rate expires today. So if you want to attend and still save $200, then make sure you register right away. In addition to Shreya Srinivasan, I spoke with John Murphy for today's podcast episode. John is the CEO of Virtual Incision. Virtual Incision literally made headlines a few weeks ago when it sent a space robot, its space mirror robot, which is a different version from its main mirror robot. Space mirror was sent to the ISS, and it was used to perform remote surgery by surgeons who were on the ground. It wasn't real surgery, but they were able to snip rubber bands and replicate surgery in space. So I got to talk with John Murphy about, obviously, his background, but also the work that Virtual Incision is doing. Shame to say, I wasn't really aware of all it was doing, and it's been around for close to 20 years, but it's really making headway. It has FDA approval for an application of its mirror robot, which is different than space mirror. And we'll talk all about that with John Murphy. In addition to having Virtual Incision on this podcast, I'm also excited to tell you that Virtual Incision is going to be part of our Surgical Robotics Week, which is a new format for Device Talks Tuesdays that takes place not this coming week, but the following week. So on Thursday of that following week, we'll have Dr. Shane Farator. He's the co-founder and chief technology officer of Virtual Incision, and Dr. Piet Hanul, who is the chief medical officer. They will be on a webinar with me talking about Virtual Incision, talking about mirror, what it can do, how it's using miniaturized tech and other advances to create robots, surgical robotic robots that are small enough to be used in any OR. So Virtual Incision's goal is to make any operating room a surgical robotic suite. So very, very cool application. So yes, join us for that discussion on the Thursday of that week. And prior to that, on that Tuesday, I'll be talking with Catherine Rieger, who's Senior Director of Human Factors and User Research at Intuitive. We've had her on our Intuitive Talks podcast before and at Device Talks West. She's fantastic. And her title is called Intuitiveness, the Art of Recognizing that Humans Remain the Most Important Component of a Surgical Robotic System. So obviously we'll be talking about user interface with Catherine Rieger. So that's on Tuesday. And then on Wednesday, we'll have a talk called Insights to Innovation, the Future of Surgery. And it'll be a presentation by Nikolai Begg, who's the Senior Director of Portfolio R&D for robotic surgical technologies at Medtronic. So I'll be on that talk as well with Nikolai Begg, and you can register for that. So these are three different talks happening on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. They're all free. They'll all have the ability for some Q&A. They'll all have some presentations. So if you're into surgical robotics, and honestly, who is not, make sure you register for those three episodes. Again, they're free. You can watch them live. You can watch them on demand. If you want to have questions answered, I would do it live. It might be more difficult to do that on demand. But please join us. It's going to be a great three discussions. First time we're doing that with Device Talks Tuesday, where we're stretching it over 3 days, focusing on a specific topic. So it's something we're trying out. We're getting a lot of great traction. A lot of people have registered already, but we want to have you there also. So that is a lot to talk about. We have a great episode today. We've got some great programming coming up on Device Talks Tuesdays. We have PSN Labs coming up this Tuesday. They always do a great job. Make sure you go to devicetalks.com to register for that. While you're there, register for the Device Talks Tuesday episodes and hang around a little longer. Go to boston.devicetalks.com to register for Device Talks Boston. This entire episode is brought to you by our friends at DornaWorks, and we'll have some messaging from DornaWorks a little later in the podcast. Two little bits. I had a great conversation with the folks there, and we'll bring that up again after our first talk with Shreya Srinivasan, and then again in the middle of my conversation with John. So, whew, that's a lot. Thanks for listening to this extended intro. But we're super busy here at Device Talks, and just super super thrilled that you're part of it. So, thanks for tuning in today. Let's get this podcast started. All right, you ready for this?
Ready.
Chris Neumarker, how are you, sir?
Hey, good to be here, Tom. Good to be here. I am sitting here drinking coffee out of my device, out of my Boston coffee mug.
And you got that at in Boston itself, or did you have that shipped to you?
I bought a Logan on the way out last year from Device Talks Boston. Ah. So I'm kind of drinking it today because, you know, it's just 2 months to go until Device Talks Boston, May 1st to 2nd.
I know, a little less than 2 months, and I'm both excited and terrified because the suspense is building, the speaker list is building. It's going to be a great couple of days. Curious though, did you get the mug? Was that a gift for the kids or the wife? Were you like last minute shopping?
You know, it's I've had this thing of like whenever I go anywhere. When I'm leaving at the airport, I'll get a mug for the city where I was. Wow. And so now our cupboard's full of a nice collection of mugs of all these different cities. It's actually really fun.
Not every time, I hope. Like, do you have like a bunch of Anaheim mugs and a bunch of Boston mugs, or you just get it once? Just get it once, right? One mug.
Just once, yeah. Actually, I do have two San Francisco mugs, you know, just one LA mug right now, but, you know, we'll see. So, but it is getting kind of crowded, but like with the house that we now have this year, the our old refrigerator didn't take magnets, but our new one does. Oh, well, so maybe I'll switch over to magnets. Maybe we'll go to magnets now.
Magnets are great. My mom was always a big fan of the spoons. Did you ever see the tiny spoons? She had a spoon collection. And yeah, when I used to go places, I would come back with a little spoon, and she was thrilled. She put it up in a little spoon rack. And
oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Like, did she have collector plates too?
No, she
like
didn't. She did have, and this is going down the, she had Hummels.
This is going down the rabbit hole.
She had Hummels. And when I was.
She had Hummels. Oh my gosh.
And when I was visiting my son at Purdue, heading back to O'Hare, I pulled into a strip mall and I ran upon, it was closed, unfortunately, the Hummel Museum.
Oh my gosh.
Which was not an impressive structure. And because it was closed and empty, I guess it didn't do so well. But at one point, there was a Hummel Museum. So.
I actually have a pair of Hummel bookends that were in my dad's bedroom in the 1940s. And my mom, and you know, I was thinking of putting it in the kid's bedroom, but like talking to my wife, it was like they're kind of creepy. So
yeah, they're
kind of hid away somewhere.
They don't translate like, very well. Yeah, yeah, they do not. Yeah, they do not translate.
I was kind of like, but they were in my dad's bedroom. Like, no.
No, but kids aren't going to pick up with that sound. Yeah. So yeah, I don't know what. Yeah, I don't have any of the Hummels that my mom had, but I'm sure they're being enjoyed by someone somewhere.
Somewhere.
Maybe they had been in the museum, and I could have stumbled upon them.
Take the kids. But anyway, we have a guest here who's saying, like, why am I sitting here listening to these?
I don't know why I find this so fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're here with Shreyas. Oh, I'll stop laughing. Yeah. We're here with Shreyas Srinivasan. She's an assistant professor of biomedical engineering at Harvard. Shreya, thanks for joining us on this ridiculous podcast.
Thank you for putting up with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom and Chris.
Oh, my God. So we're excited to have you. You're one of our great speakers at Device Talks Boston. You're going to be on our neuro panel, which is taking place on the start of day one, where we're looking at different technologies and materials and things that are sort of advancing neuro stimulation or neuromodulation and neurotreatment. So I came upon your lab at Harvard and invited you to participate, and you were kind enough to say yes. So tell our listeners a bit about yourself first. How'd you come into to choose biomedicine or the biomedical engineering as a career? And then I'm going to ask you, tell us about your lab at Harvard, but let's start with you first.
Well, I worked for a biomedical engineering startup right after high school.
Oh, neat.
Called Cardio Insight Technologies, and they were making these vests that had numerous electrodes that could actually capture kind of a 3D picture of the heart in terms of electrophysiology and allow for better diagnosis and checkups for patients that were having pacemakers. And so this was kind of my first introduction into this world where engineering and medicine collided. Before that, I was straight on the pre-med track. I was going to be a doctor. But this really showed me, you know, kind of the other side of this whole world of medicine and got me really fascinated. And then I went to Case Western, which had a phenomenal kind of biomedical program.
Ah.
Did some research there. And then when I got to grad school, did a really interesting program that was hosted between Harvard Med School and MIT. And so we actually got to take some medical school classes and do clinical rotations and understand the clinical landscape and see firsthand what the problems were and how people interacted and the gaps in technology. And then, of course, get an engineering education. So all of these kind of shaped my, you know, interest and passion for biomedical engineering. And here I am.
That's great. No, my son wants to be an engineer. He's at school at Purdue learning, and he wants aerospace. That's like the sexy thing right now, but I keep trying to steer him into biomed. So maybe we'll wear him down with more podcasts like these.
There we go. You know, Shreya, like at this point now you're at Harvard, you know, tell us about the work that you're doing at Harvard.
Yeah. So I run the Harvard Bionics Lab, where bionics stands for biohybrid organs and neuroprosthetics. And we really work on the development of these biohybrid organs, which kind of think and use the tissues of the body themselves as almost like electrical or mechanical parts. And the goal here is to bring the human and the machine closer together and really engineer neuromusculature through surgical reconstruction, incorporating synthetic actuators and sensors. And the whole, you know, mission is to think about having bidirectional neural communication with the human body, such that we can actually use all the fancy robotics that are being built and that are out there today. I originally started in the prosthetic space, working with patients that had amputations. And a big challenge there is we have a lot of passive prostheses that folks are using, mm-hmm. but the more advanced devices, the things that have multiple degrees of freedom that really articulate and can do, you know, daily activities of living with much greater functionality, most patients aren't using them. And of course, there's the challenges of kind of cost and weight and battery, et cetera. But there's also kind of the underlying usability challenge. And a lot of this comes down to the fact that the average prosthesis today, when you pick up an object, for example, without physically looking at your prosthesis, you don't know what it's touched or how it feels or how much it weighs. Mm-hmm. And so the sense of sensory feedback got me really interested So started working on that. And a lot of my work over the years has really evolved into that. And our lab continues to work on that through multiple different types of stimulation modalities. But the, you know, fundamental question is, how do we better connect the human body and these machines and get that communication to be seamless?
Well, tell me if I'm right. I mean, the technology and the prosthetic that a lot of people use today is not that much different from what was developed during the Second World War for, you know, veterans coming out of that war. And I mean, you know, when you're talking about the work you're doing, I was thinking about, you know, DECA developing the Luke arm in the 20-teens, you know, and Mobius is out there with it, but the adoption is not very high right now.
That's right. The adoption rate is quite low. And of course, there's some economic factors, but I think usability is still a pretty big challenge. And I think it's going to continue to be that way. I mean, even outside the prosthetic space, right, we're seeing all of these sort of gaming type technologies, a lot of Internet of Things types of devices. And unless we get that communication piece figured out, right, the tissue machine interface, I think it's going to be, you know, divergent paths of development. And so there's a real need to integrate. And you know, this really comes down to, like, are we talking to the body in a way that the body understands? Do we understand the neural language? Do we have those components properly synced up? There is a lot of exciting research, right? A few papers came out just earlier this year where we're showing that by increasing sensory feedback through either electrical stimulation or mechanical stimulation, patients do have better functionality. They have lower phantom pain. They're able to use the prosthesis to do more dexterous tasks. So I'm hopeful, but I think we do need an integration of these kind of new research breakthroughs with what industry is, you know, really piloting here.
I'm going to do what I do, which is kind of dumb things down to my level. Sounds like you're building cyborgs. Are you building cyborgs for you? This sounds like cyborg technology.
In some ways, yes.
Wow, that is cool.
Wow.
So how did you happen upon this particular strain of biomedical engineering? Was it something, was there a personal story of yours, or just you just find that fat, that nexus of tissue in materials to be where you wanted to focus? What kind of drew you to this particular space?
Yeah. So in graduate school, I rotated in a number of different labs to try to figure out what projects I wanted to work on. And I came across the lab of Dr. Hugh Hare, who's a bilateral amputee, and had done lots of really cool work in building these prostheses that had improved function and improved biomechanics. But also think about the adjacent problems like sockets and computation and models. And one of the big gaps that I was seeing was the divide between the robotics that were available and how easy it was for folks to use them. And so I wanted to get involved in bridging this divide, thinking about the siloed kind of worlds of engineering and surgery. And I thought that was a really interesting just area to work in. Surgical engineering isn't kind of a field unto itself. And so that's where I wanted to get involved and start working on that. I really loved, you know, the medical side of things, interacting with clinicians and surgeons and thinking about how we rebuild tissues on one hand. And on the other side, it seemed like there was this marriage that was necessary to the devices themselves. So that's how I got interested in this. Before that, I'd had, you know, some family members and friends that I'd seen struggle with neuromuscular disorders. And as much as it's prevalent in our society, you know, less than 4% of people that have a neuromuscular disorder have a restorative solution. Kind of the best in class things that we have today are like physical therapy and some assistive devices. But, you know, once you have a disorder or a kind of issue with your mobility, it really impacts your daily life. It also impacts the people around you and causes a lot of, you know, disturbance and disruption to your daily life. But we just don't have that many solutions out there. So I really wanted to work in this space and see how we could push that frontier.
So let me see if I'm hearing you correctly on this. Like you're going way beyond just like, okay, I'm amputated. I'm going to put on this like super smart prosthetic on here. Like you're saying like there's some, you know, muscle that I just can't rehabilitate that you could replace with something artificial.
Yeah. I mean, we're actually using some of the body's own muscles and rewiring them to achieve more functional connections, what we call a regenerative muscle graft. And so that's part of it. Mm-hmm. Wow. Some of the more some of the other aspects of that are we can talk to those nerves and muscles using different types of stimulation, right? This could be optogenetic stimulation. It could be electrical stimulation. More recently, some of my work in the gastrointestinal space, where I also started working on prosthetic technologies there, uses mechanical stimulation to really speak to the nervous system there.
So it sounds almost, when you start talking about that, I move away from my cyborg analogy, and I think you're going to be creating Captain America. So you're going to, you got superhero potential here as well. So you're also doing some work in robotics. I remember seeing an article a couple of years ago, this robotic capsule could deliver large protein drugs like insulin. Is that a field of yours as well?
Yeah, that's right. Worked a little bit on ingestible electronics. And a lot of those are, you know, in kind of standard drug delivery. I was interested in thinking about what other sorts of functionality we can put onto ingestible capsules, and then whether we could use that as a way to hijack and speak to the nervous system as well. The drug delivery project was actually a side project, but turned out to kind of have some really nice results. So if you've ever seen these machines that tunnel through and tunnel through like rocks and mud and create tunnels, that's where the inspiration for this came. Huh. The idea was, could we tunnel through mucus that's on the lining of your intestines to actually clear it off and allow the drugs to penetrate then into the epithelial layers and then into the bloodstream with greater ease. So we built a little pill that could, and it tunnels through mucus, peels it off, and then delivers drugs.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Wow.
And because it's able to get closer to the luminal, you know, wall, we're able to deliver these bigger drugs, things like insulin, which normally get stuck in mucus and never make it past.
Gosh, where is that in development right now?
We've actually licensed that technology out to Suono Bio, which is a startup company in the greater Boston area. And they're working on taking the next steps and scaling it up and then starting tests in humans. Yeah,
that's fantastic. That's so amazing. Kind of the if this works, you know, and can be manufactured affordably enough, I mean, this could be, you know, like people with diabetes would, you know, no longer need insulin injections or insulin pump. They could take some special insulin pill that would get the insulin into your system through your intestine.
Yeah, that's right. That's the hope, to make these sorts of administration challenges a lot easier and open up the markets for folks that can't access things like injections or inhalants or, you know, these more cumbersome administration methods.
Yeah, that would be awesome. I mean, that would be really change the quality of life for, you know, people with diabetes. So yeah, that's here's the hoping that continues to move forward. That's really cool.
So how do you view, I have conversations like these, one of the reasons I love the podcast and our conferences as well, is you meet people like yourself and you hear what they're working on and you, I don't know, you start to see the world through their prism in that, all the potential of what could be. How do you view the medtech world? Do you look at it like saying like, oh, we have so much, we have so far to go to be where I think we can be. And how close are we to kind of getting to some of these things that we're talking about? Because they sound fanciful and fantastic, but you're working on it. You just license out technology. You know, we could be seeing something probably in 5 or 10 years, but that's actually a blink of an eye when you think about it. How do you view all that, the medtech world broadly, and how close are we getting to having some of these things that you're developing, you think, in practical use and adoption?
Yeah. You know, I flip-flop on this. Some days I'm really hopeful. I see all the exciting research and all the new startups that are really making headway in this space. And it's very exciting. You know, there's Synchron and Precision Neuro and Cognito. And, you know, these folks are really kind of pushing the boundary in how we think about treatment or diagnosis or functional restoration. So that's really exciting to me. And sometimes when I think about that, it's like, wow, we're, you know, 5-10 years out from having this whole new system of healthcare that is very integrated in terms of the data in, data out, and the way we can monitor things. On the other side, some days I'm really frustrated. You go to the clinic and our technology is truly like 10, 15 years outdated. We walk around with a cell phone in our hands that can, you know, basically like access the entire internet and do all of these complicated things. And yet when you go to the hospital, some of the processors are still so antiquated. The tools that we're using are antiquated. The data is siloed in different specialties and between different systems. And, you know, it's hard as a patient, for example, for you to even get your own data and really hang on to it and understand what's happening and plug that into the different systems into which you're operating. So some days it's really frustrating. I think while we're making in advances and in learning about, say, the brain and the nervous system, we're still pretty far off from truly understanding some of the mechanisms as well as having devices that can interrogate or treat.
Yeah.
And so I go between being really hopeful and really frustrated at just the pace. I also see a lot of research that's very exciting, but that jump into a startup or into a company is still a challenge. And of course, I think it's gotten better over the years, but there's a long way to go. I think we need a lot more folks that are ready to kind of take some of these and run with them, create startups and take that risk. It is hard. I mean, med tech as a business is hard. It's hard as a startup, but yeah, we do need to accelerate the pace here if we really want to keep up.
I guess the flip side is if, you know, you've got that dedication to stick with something and get it finally into health providers after 10 or 15 years, I mean, there can be great reward that, you know, you're like, well, I just spent a decade of my life on this, but I can see this doing, you know, doing a lot of good now. And I can,
you know, in most cases, I think that's true. I think there are certain device businesses that don't end up becoming that profitable.
Yeah.
And part of that is just a long road that it takes to get there. And then finally, the sort of reimbursement structure that's possible. I think at a systemic level, as we try to move more towards value-based care, some of these systems aren't going to have as much of a tangible value that's recognizable in the short term. But our healthcare system isn't set up to incentivize or reimburse preventative kind of long-term care that is a multifactorial setup. So I think that's a challenge, right? Each device is getting reimbursed based on its individual, you know, demonstrable outcomes.
Our health system right now is so good at, like, I mean, they can patch you up, you know, if you're injured or, you know, or they can try to treat like a bad health problem. But as far as like managing you and like helping you not get these bad health problems, it's...
Yeah. I mean, something that I discuss with, you know, colleagues often is we spend an inordinate amount of money on treating patients in the last kind of terminal part of their life. Mm-hmm. And if we could just take that money and redistribute it into preventative care, things that promote healthy lifestyles, that take care of you, you know, as you age, that would be so impactful, especially as we head into kind of the next few decades. Our population is significantly, we're going to have a larger and larger aging population. And as lifespans increase, we're going to have more people in the system. And the way that it's built today, we're just not set up to handle that.
Totally.
And so we need to really think about, you know, ways to live healthier and improve the quality of life and deal with this population that is going to be aging. And it's a hard, I think, mindset shift. But if we really commit to the front end of that, I think we'll be better off and we will save money as a society.
Totally.
But it's going to really take some re-architecting of the system to get there.
A change of mindset, I think, as well, you know, which, I mean, that can always, that's the hardest thing is to change mindset and culture. I mean, but from where you are, I mean, what could technology do? What's technologically capable right now that could help a lot of people that's not being done in the health system?
There are a lot of tools that I think can help folks change their behavior. Specifically with respect to chronic diseases like obesity and diabetes. And I think if we can tackle obesity, for example, a lot of the downstream health consequences that are creating a large burden on the healthcare system would be ameliorated. So I don't have an exact answer for you, but I think if more people were to adopt these tools and really commit to some more behavioral change, that would have a huge impact. What else? I think there's a lot of technologies today that kind of track, monitor, and we need to figure out how to turn those into sticky mechanisms that then feed behavioral change. That's one I would say that I feel like is already here. It's pretty low hanging.
Like, we could have, like, technological tools that could, like, help people better manage their, like eating habits, you know, and, like, better manage their eating. And then if they still just can't do it, then you can move them quickly to other, you know, other tools. Like, okay, maybe they do need to go on, you know, GLP-1s, or, you know, maybe they do need to do bariatric surgery, right, or whatever. But it's not just let someone, you know, languish, mm-hmm, with a chronic health problem that's going to, like, cause much,
yeah,
worse problems,
agreed,
down the road.
And I think a lot of help is also, yeah, the softer side of things, right? Do folks have a good supported community in which they're living? Do they have access to meals? Do they have access to a healthcare system that's, you know, close to them, that they trust? And some of that, I think, is just in our public infrastructure that we need to build up and improve. And that, I think, will, you know, have benefits in folks' healthcare that are a little less tangible to see, but great in terms of their value and impact. Yeah.
So true.
So what my first final question, because I always have a second final question. What cool technology have we not asked you about? You've kind of picked from your portfolio, yeah, but is there something super cool that we're missing, or maybe it's not even on your website yet and you're really, really excited about?
So one of the cool things that came out was this pill that we developed called the Vibes, the vibrating ingestible bioelectronic stimulator. And this is a little pill that you swallow that mechanically stimulates your stomach, and it tricks your stomach receptors into thinking that your stomach's actually full. And so in the pigs that we tested, they consumed about 40% less food on a per meal basis. So I think it could be a neat alternative therapy for reducing intake and therefore, you know, reducing weight gain.
Interesting. Yeah, no, I think actually I think there was an article in Medical Design and Outsourcing about that. That kind of led me to you, now that you bring it up.
Well, we wrote about the PillCam technology. Like, there's a, mm-hmm, company called PillCam out in California that's got, like, a swimmable,
yeah, but,
pill that they're developing.
We also did one on that device as well, because I thought that was cool. Final question, and this is kind of one of those annoying podcast questions. If you had a magic wand and you could change sort of how industry is engaging with labs like yours, what could make your life easier? What could speed adoption and development? Do you find that they're really receptive, and that when you have a good idea, they're like, yeah, they're very encouraging? Or do you feel like there's too much, you know, come to me when you have all these boxes checked, and then maybe we'll have a conversation?
I feel like it is a bit more of the latter. I think there are some companies willing to collaborate at earlier stages, but I would love to have more industry academia collaborations where we're truly co-developing things. And then that gives, you know, the product or kind of the technology a nice off-ramp into industry where it will actually hit the clinic. I think instead of having to develop something independently and then find a partner for it later, often, you know, a lot of things just kind of die in the valley of death there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would love to have more industry collaborations and then co-develop on the R&D side and then think about really translating together. So funding and collaboration there, I think, could be really beneficial.
That's a great point. And I think academia is at the point, too, where they're very, yeah, receptive to sort of those sort of things. 20, 30, 40 years ago, I think there was more of like a, you can't work with industry because it's going to interfere with your research. But I think now there's a recognition that the two can work together.
Yeah, absolutely. And some of the tools that industry can build that we can't build in academia at scale would be really beneficial for then doing, again, kind of more basic science. And then that feeds that loop between basic, applied, and translational. And it just doesn't make sense for us to sit in academia sometimes and build those things.
Absolutely. All right. Well, there'll be a lot of industry at Device Talks Boston, and you'll be there as well, Shreya Srinivasan. Thank you for joining us at Device Talks Boston and for joining us in the podcast.
Well, thanks so much.
Yeah, looking forward to the conference.
Well, that was a great interview with Shreya Srinivasan. Now I'd like to run a short interview I recorded with this episode's sponsor, DonorWorks. Let's listen. I'm here with David Dorner, founder and chairman of the board, and Kathy Patterson. She's the new business development manager at DonorWorks. David, welcome to the podcast, and tell us about DonorWorks.
Well, thank you, Tom. I'm very honored to be here. DonorWorks is a company that I founded 24 years ago now, and we really focus on embedded systems engineering. So those are the electronics and the software that runs those electronics and embedded electronics. And They're everywhere these days, but particularly they're everywhere in the medical industry. I mean, hospital equipment, both with inpatient devices, robotic replacement arms and legs, prosthesis, for instance. And we have a lot of expertise from the aerospace and defense market, a lot of interesting technology that we're actually bringing from that market segment into the medical space as well. With that intent, we actually have increased our talent within DornaWorks. We're a company around 100 people, and we just brought on Kathy Patterson recently within the last year to head up our medical market from a business development perspective. Kathy?
Yes, thank you, David. I'm really excited to be here, especially on the talk. I bring over 25 years of experience as it relates to medical device companies and how they bring products to market. But more importantly, I also have some experience on the side of their end users, so I understand the hospital environment as well. And so I'll be able to marry that to the technologies that we're working with today at DornaWorks.
That's fantastic. Well, we'll hear more from David and Kathy a little later in the podcast. If you want to find out more about DornaWorks right now, go to its website, DornerWorks.com. That's DornerWorks.com. Now I'm going to play the interview I did with John Murphy at Virtual Incision. Once again, we're going to talk about their mirror robot, but also Space Mirror. Space Mirror is the robot that obviously went to the ISS, but Mirror is the robot system that got FDA approval. So I just wasn't sure if we made that entirely clear in the interview. So I'm telling you now, that's the deal. Let's listen. Well, John Murphy, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Tom. It's a pleasure to be with you.
I'm excited to explore this story. We don't get to talk about surgical robotics a lot, but not surgical robotics that have functioned in space and allowed for that level of remote surgery. I want to delve into that experience, which has been chronicled on CNN and elsewhere. In a moment, but let's first talk about you, John. How did you find your way into the medical device industry?
Yeah, you know, Tom, I landed at Chicago O'Hare with two bags in my hands in 1989, just to go to grad school. And so I did a master's degree in electrical engineering and computer science, and spent a few years as a software engineer. And then I went over to the business side and spent over a decade in aerospace working on things like jet engines and glass cockpits and all sorts of fantastic platforms like that. But then I was lucky enough to transfer over into the life science tools and diagnostics and optoelectronics space, imaging spaces, that really kind of hooked me around health tech. And so you know, my journey has been running some pretty big companies, big global companies. Mm-hmm. I also ran a couple of middle market private equity companies. I've now been CEO of Virtual Incision for well over a decade, almost 12 years, actually. So it's been my entrepreneurial journey that I'm really putting all my life's work together with my co-founders and team here. So that's how I got into medtech. That's the journey I've been on.
That's great. And well, I've got a lot of follow-up questions to unpack there. Yeah. Where did you hail from? Where did that flight to Chicago originate?
Yeah, London? I'm a London okay. native, and I did my undergrad in computer science in London, and I took a 6-week bus Greyhound bus tour with a few buddies around the perimeter of the U.S. back in '87, and I really put this idea into me. I loved Chicago. I thought it'd be a fantastic place to do some graduate work. So I was lucky to head over to there.
That's great, and what was the opportunity that you allowed you to move from aerospace into life sciences? I'm looking at your background here. You were at Honeywell. Yeah. Is that where you first?
Yeah, I started on with Allied Signal Aerospace, and that was a tremendous growth journey. And we ended up acquiring Honeywell. Of course, it's Honeywell henceforth. So it was a great company, but a couple of colleagues, senior guys who had run the engines division and the avionics division, had jumped out to join PerkinElmer, which they were putting into more of a life science company. And I just felt like it was a terrific opportunity to join that new vertical. I'd always had a keen interest in health sciences and health tech and kind of the greater mission around all that. And so I'm glad I was able to make the switch.
That's great. And what was the transition like for you? You were COO of Perkin Elmer. You became CEO of Celerity and then NDS Surgical. But how did you move into the CEO of Perkin Elmer role? That sounds a bit removed from engineering. And I'm sure there were many steps in between. But how did that leadership opportunity come to be?
Yeah, it was nice. In the aerospace world, I'd done a lot of global work and worked on lots of different product types across aerospace. The first opportunity was really in the optoelectronics world. So I was coming from running an avionics business, very much, mission critical, hardcore avionics type products for business and general aviation. So I was coming from that world, and Greg Summey at Perkin Elmer at the time asked me to go run their optoelectronics business, which I think was in 28 sites in, 15 different countries.
And, wow.
A big chunk of that was in medical imaging and med tech from sensors and things like this. But then as I kind of grew with the company, I took a big leap. The biggest leap was going into the biochemistry world, right?
I bet,
the life science tools and diagnostics. But I love the core deep tech around things like mass spectrometer and all these liquid handling kind of platforms. But I had a lot of chemistry to learn for the reagent side and things like this as well. So I feel like I was very lucky just to have that kind of broad set of experiences from components to full-on complicated systems. So, yeah.
That's great. So, and you became CEO of NDS Surgical Imaging in 2008. Was that a smaller startup, or was that one of the private equity companies you referenced?
Yeah, it was one of the PE roles, and it was very interesting. At Perkin Elmer, I'd run the medical imaging business, which was more about digital X-ray detectors and cardiac detectors, and it revolutionized the old X-ray business, which was a 100-year-old tube business that went digital. Going into NDS was really interesting because it was mainly in surgical imaging. Mm-hmm. So I worked with all the great imaging companies like Karl Storz and, Pentax and Fujinon, Strikers of the world with their imaging towers. But it also brought me closer to surgical robotics because we were a large supplier to Intuitive Surgical. So I felt like I got a really great look at this incredible company bringing robotics to the operating room, executing well, kind of Navy SEAL team, kind of execution in engineering and in ops and in sales. And that was kind of my first real inkling of what this all could be for robots in the operating room.
What is your and I bring this up often, but people look at surgical robotics initially anyway, and they saw it as something that was just sort of a misapplication of technology, that it wasn't necessary, that surgeons could do the job earlier on. This was, I'm talking 10, 15 years ago. We've moved past that. Yeah. But at the time when you sort of came to know Intuitive and came to know surgical robotics, what opportunities and potential, I'm curious, did you see coming from your executive background, but your engineering background, did you sort of have a lightning bolt moment where you're like, yes, this makes perfect sense? Or did you need some convincing? What was that introduction like for you?
Yeah, I think I initially connected on the technical side.
Yeah, sure.
It was just this beautiful kind of integrated precision, closed loop control, integrated visualization. And it was almost like, putting an automatic transmission in a car, it seemed to me, where you get this beautiful dexterity and visualization that you can then control your environment and apply all sorts of tools, I think, there. And so that was the real thing that got me. But then, I happened to meet at the request of an investor who'd come and asked me to to chat to these two co-founders at Virtual Incision at the JP Morgan Healthcare Conference.
Oh, okay. Where else are you going to be? Yeah, of course.
In a hotel room. And, you know, the two co-founders there came in with what was the Alpha One mini robot. And this idea of a little robots on the inside instead of huge robots reaching in from the outside just grabbed hold of me. And it was, you know, their vision and working with them that I felt like, wow, this could be something spectacular to kind of change the game. Mm-hmm. I felt like you could have, you know, a mainframe robot in one or two rooms in a hospital, but what about the other 90% of ORs? What mm-hmm. about the other 90% procedures? Even more when you took a global lens to it. And I felt like there was a lot of things from you know, the complexity that could be eliminated with standardized rooms and staffs and big machines and setup times and turnover times. And I felt like if we were really going to bring this to a much, much broader population of surgeons around the world and patients, then we needed to really, really work on simplifying the whole environment. And that's kind of been our journey. Our mission has been, it's rather audacious, actually. It's mm-hmm. to make every OR robot ready, right? And so we had to really work on making things small and easy and simple and less cables and easy to set up. And, you know, we made it portable. It comes out of a surgical tray, just like so many other medical devices. So that was kind of the genesis of how I started thinking about surgical robotics and this journey that we've been on mini robots.
It's interesting, and this is where I'm going to reveal my East Coast bias or my flyover yeah. attitude. But I'm embarrassed yeah. to say I didn't realize that Virtual Incision has been around for that long, and I'm anxious to hear sort of how you transition from or if you've transitioned from where you're talking about. But just to sort of set the scene in 2012, I mean, you know, Stryker hadn't bought Mako yet. Intuitive was out there. This was still very much a newish concept. Yeah. And I feel like what you're talking about is almost like you're moving from the computers that fill a room to having a computer on your desk. Like this is yes. kind of that level of transition. We have Ken Olson of saying, no one's ever going to want a computer on their desk. Like, it's that big of a leap, it seems like. So let's talk about 2012. How did you yeah. come to decide to join the company? And is Mira the outcome of that conversation you had in that hotel room in San Francisco, or is it an iteration or a completely new generation from that initial yeah. initial concept?
Well, it's been a really, really fun journey and one of perseverance and grit, because for all the reasons you said, you know, funding's hard, the tech's hard, the applications are hard. But I harken back a little bit to Dave Rosa at Intuitive. Mm-hmm. Even in those days, people were, you know, slinging names at those guys everywhere and wondering what are they doing with these machines. But that squad knew they had something, right? And I was up close enough to realize that, you know what, these guys really do have something. Mm-hmm. I thought that what captured me, I felt like they were enabling kind of straight stick robots, right? With big robots outside, cable driven. But the beauty of the vision from Shane and Dimitri was this little robot where you could have this perfect triangulation of your instruments and your vision, which is so necessary for fundamental laparoscopic kind of surgery techniques. And I felt like, wow, if we make that small enough, we can put that anywhere in the abdomen and we can bring a whole new paradigm of robotics kind of in vivo, right, inside mm-hmm. the abdominal cavity here. But it just didn't come to Mira. We've built dozens and dozens and dozens of prototypes. Everything in the device is custom. It's been a journey of miniaturization. we went through, from when I first started back then, from Alpha 1, which was something you had to assemble in vivo, right? Because it was too big to fit through a port. And then we went to Alpha 2, and we were able to put one arm in at a time and slide them together. And then we would just use, a standard laparoscope for the vision. But then we got to Alpha 3, and this was kind of around 2015. And that's when we integrated our first robotic flex tip camera with the robot, and we could fit it. It was small enough for us to go try some human cases. So we did outside US, first in human, in Asuncion in Paraguay, a few colectomy cases. And we learned a ton. We learned that we needed way more dexterity and reach with the robot. We learned that our camera needed to go absolutely everywhere. So again, we incorporated then. Oh, and it, by the way, it needed to be another third smaller, at least. So it was taking these perfect little micromotors, all the custom gearing, all the beautiful embedded software that controls these in a beautiful, precise way that's easy to learn and pick up, and making it small enough and integrated enough to be able to do what we consider the marquee procedure in abdominal surgery, the multi-quadrant procedure of colon resection. So, eventually we got to Alpha 5. Through these iterations, Tom, and then eventually that got us to Mira, and then we really started our de novo IDE journey with the FDA at that juncture.
So over that time, did your mission somewhat change? Because if earlier on you had you envisioned a robotic system that you could have inside the body, and there's other companies that are trying to do something not exactly like that, but something similar where they're putting these tiny little robotic surgeons, hopefully they don't have them commercially, but they hope to do that someday. But did you move from that vision to this turn any OR into a RES or surgical robotic equipped OR? Is that the mission you have today sounds different than the mission you had initially when you signed on in 2012?
Yeah, I think it was the mission initially was always about mini.
Okay.
And self-contained.
Okay.
And put this anywhere in the abdomen. And then what we realized is that, if we were to be able to solve all these other elements that you see with mainframe robots, or any cable or pedestal robots, all of them actually are in that kind of mold, that, Intuitive and Da Vinci pioneered. So we wanted to be completely unique. We wanted to be very small and self-contained. And that over time really enabled us to think about, this is how you get to the other 90% of procedures, the other 90% of ORs in these different settings. Mm-hmm. And so kind of that's how the mindset has progressed.
Let's talk about Mirror. Looking at the imagery on your website, and we'll go into more technical detail. You're kind enough to be part of a webinar we're putting on in a couple of weeks, and folks can register for that to see more. But looking at the picture on your website, I mean, it looks like a single arm with and I'm using the camera to show you what it is. You know what it is, and no one listening to this can see it. But it's a single arm with two fingers at the end, for lack of a better word. And I'm looking at the imagery on your website, and I see an operating room table, and this single arm is fixated above an empty operating room table by just looks like a simple arm connecting device. So, explain to me what is inside Mirror. I mean, you have a compare and contrast on your website. You've got what looks to be maybe a Da Vinci like system, and yours, and I don't know how I'm supposed to conceive that what you have can do what all of that does. Help me understand that.
So this, Tom, this is the essence of it, right? So let's see. There's a number of elements to the system. I think the star of the show is the mini bot. So this is a set of mechatronic assemblies and tiny little electronics that are built into two arms. And we've got a single-use instruments in each hand. So in the left hand, we have a bipolar grasper. And then in the right hand, we have a monopolar scissors. And then we have a detachable camera that goes down the sternum, or the base link, we call it, of the mini-bot. And that's the world's first flex-tip robotic camera. So that camera is special. It's got a little robot in the handle. It's got all the light sources in the handle. And then it drives through the scope to this four-way pinpoint accurate, you know, 70 degrees in any direction laparoscope. And so it's that really is the heart of what we call, you know, the mini bot and the camera. Now that's attached to the bed via, like you called it right, just a surgical retraction arm. And keeps it very stable. And we currently use a gel port for the access to the abdominal cavity, basically through an umbilical incision into the insufflated abdomen. So this little robot kind of goes in straight, brings its arms up, opens out wider, and then presents this perfectly triangulated laparoscopic field, and you can put that anywhere. And so we can do it because and it's strong. It's every bit as strong as a mainframe robot and has great dexterity. But it's because the motors are so close to the you know, to the actual actuation points for the instruments. Whereas in a mainframe, you got miles of cables. You've got 2 meters away a cable, a big motor coming through, and you need a lot of strength as the physics. It's, you know, to just move that tip in the mainframe robot from a great distance. So there's a little bit of physics working on our size, on our side, that helps us be really, really small, just as strong and dexterous and have all this precision and control, instead of having cables and or pedestals and big arms reaching in from the outside, which we felt like always was a much, much more complex setup. All requiring draping and a coordination, particularly for multi-quadrant surgery, which is quite difficult.
Okay, so you are honoring the original mission of the company. This is a version of that. You're actually putting a tiny surgeon inside the person's body.
Absolutely. Yeah, we were founded in 2006, actually.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yes. So I joke with Shane, who's been cranking on this, to not worry, Shane. You know, don't worry. You're going to be a 20-year overnight success.
And exactly.
It's really the culmination of our life's work coming together on this single mission of, you know, mini robots, self-contained mini robots that you can sterilize easily, that come in a sterilization tray, and that you know, you can move to any OR, any setting, or even any spacecraft.
I want to talk about that in a moment, but just last question about mirror tech. Is it reusable?
Yes. So there's a reposable element to this. I mentioned single-use instruments, so that's just a one-time. Okay. But the actual mini-bot itself can be VHP sterilized, just a regular sterilization, as can the camera. And our initial label calls for 15 times.
Okay.
You can sterilize this. But we're looking to extend that over time because the core mechatronics engine I kind of talked about is really designed for thousands and thousands of hours. It's a workhorse, beautiful piece of machinery. So we're going to apply service intervals at each of these 15 use marks to bring it up to brand new, you know, to check on, we call them skins or sleeves or surface loops or some of those types of things, and make sure it's a perfectly new performance. And then we'll be able to present for another 15 uses. So we think we can get about 60 uses on our robot and maybe up to 90 uses on our camera. So at the same time as building this, we think another game changer that Mini provides is really on the cost of goods side. This again, it's £2 instead of £2,000. It has exponentially less parts, of course. It's something you can build at an exponentially different cost point. Mm-hmm. And we think, particularly as you think about maybe OUS or the surgery center, where you have different reimbursements and things like this, we need to have an economic proposition that makes sense for the company, but also makes sense for these different sites of care. So we think Mini brings that under the hood. That's coming when we think about the Mini RAS, the miniaturized robot as well.
We'll take a break from this conversation to bring back our sponsor, DornerWorks. I'm here with David Dorner. He's founder and chairman of the board, and Kathy Patterson. She is business development manager. David, you mentioned you did work previously in the aerospace defense industries. What are some of the challenges that you're solving in those industries that translate into the medical device market?
Sure, Tom. So we've done a lot of work with some of the DOD, DARPA, for instance, where we've invented a cybersecurity technology that really helps proliferation of embedded electronic systems and interconnectivity, and which really directly applies to medical systems as well. You definitely want to keep a system such as a robotic system that's operating on a patient that may be connected to the internet, either through Wi-Fi or the hospital's Ethernet, protected from cybersecurity vulnerabilities.
That's a great point, David. How will these challenges evolve and possibly be solved with the rise of technologies like artificial intelligence and machine learning?
Sure. So the advantage of AI and ML is that you can move those algorithms down into the embedded system, into the embedded device. So for instance, as I was mentioning robotics earlier in a patient maybe where you have a robot, that those algorithms can be implemented inside the robot with something that we have an expertise in called FPGAs. And that's an acronym. It stands for field programmable gate arrays, but essentially it's a computerized programmable computer chip that's very fast and can do things in parallel. So unlike a microprocessor in your computer, for instance, like on your laptop, this would do multiple things in parallel. It can do them very fast and efficiently. And that allows us to implement a lot of these advanced AI and ML algorithms right down in the embedded system.
And I would add to that, it's been my experience over the years, there's so many medical device companies collecting data that they're collecting it and they don't know what to do with it. And some of it's really good, some of it's not so great, but to be able to filter through that using FPGA is an advancement all on its own. And that is really what we'll bring to med device companies.
Yeah, and for Kathy's point, that allows you to do a lot more of the processing down the embedded system as opposed to just dumping the network with raw data that has to be post-processed. This allows you to process the data in real time with your AI and ML algorithms in an FPGA and then send out just the result to the network.
Right, exactly.
So Kathy, with data security becoming a top concern for device manufacturers, can you share advice on getting ahead of the evolving regulations and helping to ensure patient privacy?
Well, the good news is we've always had a big focus on patient privacy anyway. Everybody knows that. But because technology is advancing so quickly, it's become easily penetratable because we're using more wearables. We have more things going on out in the field. And we really have to get down to what's going to be good for the patient and the company that's providing those wearables. You don't want somebody to hack into your pacemaker, but that's what we're facing today because of all the connectivity. So we're trying to connect new things. We're trying to connect legacy things. So really what it comes down to is using a third party to help you get there, because that's the only way you're going to be able to stay ahead of the game.
In some of the areas that we can benefit that problem, as Kathy described, is what I mentioned earlier, with our cybersecurity firewall systems that we developed with DARPA funding that really has an applicability here to this problem set.
And finally, Kathy, do you have any general advice for device manufacturers vetting a new product idea? What are some of the potential roadblocks that manufacturers might not be considering?
Well, I can't get it all into a couple of minute answer. But what I will say is understanding what you are trying to solve is first and foremost, and to begin with the end in mind, because everybody gets tied up into what's going to happen with validation and testing. You need documentation. And sometimes what happens is you come up with a great idea, but you didn't think it all the way through to the end. So try to remember, you got to keep that regulation, the FDA, all of those things on the front end, not on the back end. And that would be the best advice I could give any medical device company out there. And use third party, again, third party for validation, documentation, and all of the things that the hospital and the FDA is going to want from you.
And one thing I like to keep in mind as well is something I bring in from the aerospace and defense world is that when we're designing systems, embedded electronic systems to help aerospace and defense, we're thinking about the soldier. How can we help the soldier? And we keep that frame of mind. Medical, it's really just the same thing. You're thinking about the patient. How can you help the patient? What is your technology doing that really is helping the patient? And it sounds all maybe obvious to say, but if you have that framework in mind as you go through the steps that Kathy mentioned, then keep things in perspective.
All right. Well, thank you, DonorWorks, for sponsoring this episode of Device Talks Weekly. If you want to find out more information about DonorWorks, go to its website. DonorWorks, that's spelled DonorWorks.com. That's DonorWorks.com. Where are you? And I do want to talk about this space experience, but where are you in development? Do you have a projection for commercialization? And I'll have a follow-up question about that.
Yeah, we do. So we're very lucky to have this de novo authorization for the FDA for minimally invasive colectomy. We just received that. And so our approach is to first do...
Yes, thank you. You just announced that.
Exactly.
Oh, Lordy, okay. Yeah, that is a big one.
We're the first company in the world to go through in soft tissue the new regimen from the FDA of a de novo and a US-based IDE. It's a very, very rigorous paradigm, which is ultimately very good for the patient. But now we're here, we're going to take our time and we're going to first do a limited market release. We're launching what's called the MIRA First Access Program. So over the next year, we'll stand up about 10 different centers all around the United States, and we'll be embarking on colectomy surgery at these different centers. So we'll be learning all the clinical, the technical, all of the logistics, service support, training elements, in the field here before we do a full commercialization. So that's kind of the major goals around MIRA in colon. But the two other elements that are super exciting this year is that we're going to start a GYN study. And so we've got a Swiss hysterectomy study on the docket. And then also we've made an even smaller version of MIRA called Mini MIRA for things like general surgery for ventral and inguinal hernia or gallbladder removal. We're going to do an outside the U.S. First in human study, perhaps down in Argentina or something like this, to learn about general surgery. So you're going to see us add around this de novo, this new medical device category that we call miniature RAS. Is we're going to have a picket fence of new indications for all sorts of soft tissue and solid organ indications. But then you'll see a new devices. We'll have new needle drivers. We're working on a vessel sealer. We're working on fluorescence imaging. You know, all these kind of, and the smaller, even the smaller mini bot. So that's kind of the journey that we're embarking on to enable this mini-RAS paradigm shift.
Wow. So who do you see as the, when you envision a customer of MIRA or user, or is it traditional big city acute care hospital? Is it ambulatory surgery centers? Is it rural hospitals? It's probably going to be all of the above, but is there one type of facility that you kind of see this being really the answer for, and that's the one where you're really going to be pushing to sell toward or to?
That's a great question, Tom. Thanks. I think it's really exciting. First and foremost, we see Mira as being complementary to mainframe devices.
Okay.
So and the goal really is to accelerate RAS adoption, robot-assisted surgery adoption. And so, but it's going to be a journey. I'll give you a couple of examples. Our first access sites, we'll probably have a couple of great academic centers out of the 10 or 12. Mm-hmm. But we'll also have some of the absolute highest volume specialist practices in the country. Mm-hmm. And we'll also have some of the great community hospitals. So we're going to have quite a selection. And so we're going to learn about those different environments just through our first access. But then we'll be working with some of the biggest IDNs in the country as well. Mm-hmm. And I think with them, it's this journey of moving from inpatient settings for things like colon to the HOPD for maybe things like hysterectomy and other procedures in that vein. And then ultimately, it's this, I think, forging a profitable path for these IDNs to robotics in the ASC. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the journey ultimately where so much of the general surgery and everyday procedures like hernias and gallbladders, for example, or, you know, hysterectomy, oophorectomy, myomectomy, all the gynae type procedures can make sense in those types of settings. So that's the journey we see in the US. But then, you know, we're really excited about the global side here. You know, Swiss is our first little step in the direction of Europe and CE mark. You know, Buenos Aires would be our first little step to help and understand Latin America, because we think places like Argentina, of course, but Brazil and Mexico, there's, I think the mini bot is going to be very, very important. Hmm. And then we're thinking about, of course, Japan, such an important market, and Korea, where maybe something like gastrectomy, which is so prevalent, could be a great clinical first step in North Asia. And then ultimately, we think India, this could make so much sense to drive adoption in these other areas, which really traditionally, Tom, haven't been, huge robotic environments. Mm-hmm. It's really been, the US and then a little bit in Asia and some footholds in Europe. But there's great laparoscopic skills in these countries. And I think robotics can really, in the form of mini robots, can really help those types of areas. So I don't know, we've got an exciting journey around geographies, indications, and devices that we've got to build. So it's really just this early in the journey that we're thinking through this.
Interesting. And I've been teasing this the whole time. So let's talk about the space mission. Yes. Mira was sent up to ISS. It was used to perform a mock surgery on some rubber bands there. How did that come to be? And what does that exercise demonstrate? And how important is that demonstration to Virtual's future? Do you see this as primarily something that will be used remotely? Is it just you're just showing one arrow in your quiver? How important is this demonstration mm-hmm. going to be to Mira and Virtual Incision's future?
Yeah, you know, there's a nice heritage with our company in working with NASA. So Shane Farriter, our co-founder and CTO, he's an MIT PhD, beautiful mechanical engineer, right? But he also was a Mars rover guy and worked at three different NASA sites. And so we've had support from NASA and Army, actually, inside the company, doing things like some remote surgery, but also flying on the Vomit Comet, you know, the zero-G airplane with NASA. And so this has been a journey. You know, NASA and wants to do surgery in all kinds of remote spaces and things like this. So we thought this was a really nice opportunity, you know, to really show remote capabilities. But I think we're getting to the point of being able to expand our mission a little bit further. So, you know, making every OR within your four walls is already a big mission, right? Mm-hmm. That's again, it's the other 90% of ORs. So that's a lot. But I think one day this you can extend it beyond those four walls. Even in the US, it's quite startling. I think fully one third of counties in the United States don't have access to one surgeon. And so over time, we think mini robots simplifies the patient side of a potential remote surgery setup. So you can have specialists at a center and operating up to maybe 500 miles away, mm-hmm. where you could perform mini robot surgery with very little load latency and enable surgeries you know, that are either open today or in rural settings today and have access to specialists. So we're going to try a Lincoln. We've done 5 remote surgeries across town in Lincoln, about 10 miles away. But we're going to try Lincoln to Chicago this year and see what kind of latency we would get just in a preclinical setting over 500 miles. The ISS, we did 6 surgeons operating, you know, on simulated surgery tissue, rubber bands, but very much, you know, understanding what latency was and the kind of feedback there. But we think we can now – that the ISS is 250 miles away, right? Mm-hmm. So taking it to Chicago, we think, is about the right distance to understand, you know, what's possible in the U.S. So whether it's in 5 years or 10 years' time, we've seen tele-training, tele-proctoring, telepresence adopted, and we think over time even the SRS telesurgery special congress that was just held in Orlando, I think it could be just the gestation point of a kickoff into remote surgery. So our space work kind of ties into our work on US that we think one day could make a lot of sense on Earth as well.
Final question, I think. I usually have another one, but does your ties to Nebraska, you're being based, does that give you clearer insight on the need for long distance surgery, for rural surgery? I mean, a lot of the most surgical robotics companies are going to be outside of Boston or outside of San Jose or San Francisco, where yes. they've got access to surgeons right there already. You're an area where obviously in your big cities, you've got great surgeons as well, but yeah. there's probably 100 miles away, very little access to quality surgery without a long car ride. Does this give you visibility perhaps that other robotic surgery companies don't have, and has it influenced your mission?
Well, you know, we're proud to be in Lincoln, Nebraska.
Sure.
To your point, it's really unusual. It's usually on the coast, but we're a spin out of the university in Nebraska, and we've got this beautiful new building. We've got opened a new headquarters in Lincoln just about a year ago, and we do all of our final assembly and test of our robots, our cameras, our instruments, our consoles, our companion cards, all in Lincoln. And we think we've got a nice home for the next 5 years or so for the manufacturing side. And we also have all of our R&D and training center and things set up there. So we've got a lovely setup there. But you know, it is interesting. There's maybe one or two big centers in the state in Nebraska. And, you know, the rural setting, it's a big state, does kind of feed into our notion. And you know, as well as the Great Plains states, we've been basically funded through Midwest investors mm-hmm. on this whole journey, expanding that a little bit now. But we kind of, I think that does, you know, add to our sensibilities a little bit of what we're trying to achieve around some of this stuff. So perhaps, But I've had a lot of time in the Bay Area, and Shane's learned a lot in Cambridge out east, and we have teams and suppliers from all of these regions too. So I think we get infused from best practices all around the world.
Sure. Excellent. Well, if part of your intention was to keep a low profile, you've given that up. Those days are done. It's great to tell to hear your story. And again, thanks for being here today, for being part of our webinar that's coming up in a couple of weeks. And I'm hoping we'll have you at a Device Talks meeting sometime soon. John Murphy, thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Tom, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
All right, well, that is a wrap. I hope you really enjoyed that episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast. I know I did. Lots going on in the medtech world, and we're just so excited to bring some of it, a small taste of it, to you. Once again, lots for you to take advantage of at Device Talks. Of course, register for Device Talks Boston. That's happening on May 1st and 2nd. As I said, I'm recording this on March 8th. Our early bird rate expires today. So if you want to save $200, please go to devicetalks.com. Actually, it'll take you to boston.devicetalks.com and register for devicetalks.com. You can also, before that, register for our Device Talks Tuesdays Surgical Robotics Week. You can find that at devicetalks.com. We can also register for our upcoming Device Talks Tuesdays with PSN Labs. But both are free. The PSN Labs Device Talks Tuesdays and our Surgical Robotics Week, which is actually three different episodes. Those are also free as well. So go to devicetalks.com to register for those. You can watch those live or on demand. As for this podcast, please subscribe to Device Talks Podcast Network so you don't miss any of our podcasts. We've got lots coming your way, lots more that we're working on. I mentioned last time that we have a project we're working on with Edwards Life Sciences. Very excited about that. That's going to be a slight different variation of what we've done in the past. And I know you'll enjoy that as well. And of course, you'll be able to receive our other fantastic podcasts also. Also, please share this podcast episode. Like I said, there's lots of cool tech that we talked about. Share this on social media. When you do, connect with me, Tom Salemi. Connect with Chris Newmarker. Chris, as in a new marker, he's the executive editor of Mass Device, and also follow Device Talks and Mass Device as well, and subscribe to our Device Talks YouTube channel. We're building that one up slowly, so get in on the ground floor of that. All right, folks, thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast. Tune in next week. We'll have another episode of Device Talks Weekly for you. And also an episode of Abbott Talks. So thanks for tuning in, everybody. Have a great weekend and or day, evening, morning, whenever you're listening to this delightful program.